ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Capricorn Highway in Queensland is more than a 500k stretch of highway that cuts through mining and cattle country.
We have people who are discharged from their employment and they don't live here and they do a drive-in, drive-out thing. And when that happens, they want to get home. They don't want to sit behind a cattle truck. This is a pipeline through to the west and to the north. So we have big trucks on the road all the time. Now, all of that is a recipe for disaster.
Dr. Ewan McPhee, he says the medical trauma of road crashes is putting enormous pressure on regional health systems. We're going to have more on that. And locals in a small country town in New South Wales dispute the transportation of wind turbines through an avenue of trees planted in honour of World War I veterans.
And the wind tower companies are now saying, we want to come through here with our massive wind tower trucks and we want to butcher your trees to make sure we can get through. I mean, I don't feel anyone, despite what they might feel about the role in renewable energy, the butchering of an Anzac Memorial by a European multinational wind tower developer doesn't make sense.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. We start in Victoria with the news convicted murderer Aaron Patterson will spend at least 33 years behind bars for murdering three relatives and trying to kill a fourth with beef Wellington laced with death cap mushrooms. Supreme Court Judge Christopher Beale imposed a life sentence on Aaron Patterson for the 2023 murders of her in-laws Don and Gail Patterson and Gail Patterson's sister Heather Wilkinson. Aaron Patterson was also convicted of the attempted murder of Mrs. Wilkinson's husband, Ian. Justice Beale described the crime as an enormous betrayal.
Your victims were all your relatives by marriage. More than that, they had all been good to you and your children over many years, as you acknowledged in your testimony. Not only did you cut short three lives and cause lasting damage to Ian Wilkinson's health, thereby devastating the extended Patterson and Wilkinson families, you inflicted untold suffering on your own children, whom you robbed of their beloved grandparents. Four generations of the extended Patterson and Wilkinson families have been traumatised by your crimes.
Justice Beale, the full sentencing was televised and broadcast in a trial that has had untold media coverage. The Mushroom Trial, as it became known, has spawned numerous podcasts, documentaries and a soon-to-be-released drama series and several books. During the trial, the towns at the heart of the action, Morwell, Leongatha and Currumburra, were inundated with a massive media contingent. And our reporter, Tavleen Singh, has been in the Gippsland communities of Leongatha and Currumburra today, where the victims of this crime lived. Now, Tavleen, all the action today was in Melbourne, but you're where it all happened. What was the response to the sentencing of Aaron Patterson today?
You're so right, Sinead. The action might have been in the Supreme Court in Victoria, in Melbourne, but the effect of it, the impact of it, is being very well felt in these communities that I was visiting today, Leongatha and Currumburra, where Ian Wilkinson is from, where Simon Patterson, the husband of Aaron Patterson, is from. And this is the community that knows all of these people. They know the victims. They know the murderer. So they're reeling in from the shock of it all. And when I went to the cafes, to the local shops, when I spoke with the people on the street, I even spoke with the mayor there, they all knew about it. They knew the sentencing was today. They had listened to the sentencing. Like you mentioned earlier, it was broadcast live, and they were quite happy with the transparency from the legal system. But there were two side of views that I was getting. One was that they listened throughout to the entirety of the broadcast of what Justice Beale was mentioning, and some were like, we just grabbed the headlines at the end of it, we just can't take any more. But the one thing that was common throughout was that they were all relieved that it's coming to an end, that they can look forward, they can move forward. They really just want the media out of there. In fact, I was speaking with the mayor of the South Gippsland Shire, under which Leongatha and Currumburra come, Mayor John Skelling, and he said, look, I just want the media to go away. We have had enough. We just want to move forward. And it was as I had the microphone in his face and said, look, I'm sorry, and we will move out of here. So the sense is that they all just want to move forward. They've had enough with the tragicness of the situation. Another common thread was they all said it's extremely sad, and they were thinking about and Patterson and Simon Patterson's children who are going to have to live with this for the rest of their lives.
Ian Wilkinson was surrounded in press today, Tavleen, when he made his statement, and he's been inundated by press. We'll have a listen to what he had to say.
We're grateful for their skills that brought this truth to light. And I'm also very grateful for the kindness and compassion they showed us, me and my family, throughout the long process that has brought us to this day. I thank the people of the Leongatha and Currumburra communities in particular. Your thoughtfulness and care has been a great encouragement to us.
Ian Wilkinson there. Now, Tavleen, he mentioned the support of his community. You went to his church today. Did you get a feel for that?
Absolutely. Ian Wilkinson is a very beloved part of this community, much like the other victims, his wife, Heather Wilkinson, Dawn and Gail Patterson. They're all quite beloved. You can sense the warmth that Ian Wilkinson has from this community. When I went by the Baptist Church of Currumburra, there was a statement outside. They said, justice is very important. However, it doesn't bring back the victims, the people that they have lost. It also said, we also continue to pray for Erin, a kindness that Ian Wilkinson also showed in his victim impact statement that he gave a couple of weeks back. So he is very well supported, and I think the community is very close-knit. So even though they've gone through this tragic incident and they describe it as extremely sad, everything that has happened, they want to support him and they want to help him move forward as well as heal themselves. In fact, the statement in the end does mention that they want the time and space to heal and move forward. So that sense is quite common there.
Given that, I think that's where we'll leave it. Tavleen Singh in Leongatha, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you, Sinead.
ABC Australia Wide.
Australia is synonymous with koalas for international tourists, and a big ticket item when visiting is the opportunity to see a koala in the wild. And that's what the New South Wales government is banking on, committing to the Great Koala National Park, a new national park covering the area from Coffs Harbour to Kempsey and as far north as Grafton. But committing to a national koala park has been contentious. Conservationists, like you just heard, argue it's about time as koalas are listed as an endangered species. The Koala National Park is big, covering patches that stretch almost a 500,000 hectares. But it's also an area that's harvested by the timber industry for species like ironbark, spotted gum, blackbutt and tallowwood. Industry argues it was blindsided by the Minns government's announcement, and the immediate temporary moratorium will have an impact on 6 out of more than 25 timber mills in the region, affecting about 300 jobs. David Claughton has put this story together for us.
The New South Wales Premier Chris Minns made the announcement on the weekend.
An immediate moratorium on logging for a Great Koala National Park on the mid-north coast, the full 176,000 hectares. We are faced with a situation where koalas will go extinct in the wild by 2050 unless we make this decision.
More than 175,000 hectares of state forest will be added to the existing reserves in the area, making it the state's largest national park at 476,000 hectares, almost 500,000. It'll run inland of Coffs Harbour, going south down to Kempsey and as far north as Grafton. The Nature Conservation Council said the new park turns around the trajectory of decline for koalas and will protect 20% of the remaining population. The Coffs Harbour branch president of the state's National Parks Association, Dr. Graham Douglas, welcomed the decision.
It is a momentous decision. It's the right decision. It'll mean that koalas will have forests that are left intact and that they will actually be able to move across the landscape without worrying about the fact that compartments have been removed.
The state government says the tourism industry will be a big winner from the new park, and it will provide job seeker packages for about 300 mill workers from about 6 mills that will be directly affected by the moratorium. James Youth, the CEO of the Australian Forest Products Association, says it's a terrible decision and a kick in the guts for workers.
There are people who went to work on Friday who are now, it's Monday, and don't have a job to go to. There are harvesting contractors who still have equipment in the assessment area, the now park, that simply don't have a job.
James Yust doesn't know which six mills will get the funding package to help with the transition.
Now, a lot depends on who those mills are and what negotiations happen, because we've got 40% of the timber resource on the north coast now locked up in that national park, and that will have flow-on effects not just for those six mills, not just for the 25 mills in closer proximity, but for every mill on the north coast with the way wood flow works.
The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, said one of the key reasons he decided to support the largest park size recommended was because Essential Energy decided to stop using hardwood poles for the electricity network. They'll use composite poles made of structural fibres and thermoset resin, which are fire resistant. James Hughes from the Australian Forest Products Association says that's a big mistake.
You can do it, but it's not the right call. Those composite cut poles will cost five times the price of a hardwood power pole and have five times the emissions. So out of the end of a transition, you're going to have a dirtier supply chain when it comes to carbon, and your power prices are going to be higher.
Michael Kemp, Nationals MP, is critical of Labor's decision to create the park. He thinks the biggest risk to koalas is fire, and turning state forests into national park will just increase that risk.
Severe bushfire is by far and away the biggest threat to their health. So, I think we should be managing our forests, and certainly not locking something up and throwing away the key. I mean, that's what they've been doing in national parks in the past that are west of the highway. Certainly, the cost of $121 per hectare of national parks compared to $8.50 per hectare of state forest is pretty significant. So it is going to be a significant financial drain on the government. And, I think we should be encouraging, sustainable harvesting operations to use the most sustainable product we have.
Dr. Graham Douglas from the National Parks Association says the claim that bushfires will get worse under national parks management is just a myth.
This is an ongoing myth that people say national parks are somehow or other bad fire managers. They're not. They deliver more fire management activities in the state than anyone else. And they do it across the whole state. They've got 10% of the land mass, and they are experts at fire management.
Tony Callaghan from the Australian Workers Union told Kath Adams a lot of forestry skills will be lost if this decision goes ahead.
When you lose industries like this, they're lost forever. And the Forestry New South Wales employees in particular are highly trained for firefighting and managing pest species, and I'm concerned that all those special skills will be lost, in addition to the skills of the harvesters and the haulage contractors and everyone else. It's a sad day.
He said the union will be supporting forestry workers this week, and they'll be fighting to overturn the decision in the longer term.
I might be more stubborn than most, but I don't believe this is over yet, and I'll be doing everything that I can on behalf of the Australian Workers Union members to ensure that, if we can, we reduce the size of this park. It's not being legislated. It'll go before Parliament some stage in the future, and I'll be lobbying MPs to put pressure on the government to come up with a more sensible approach to where we can have a thriving, responsible timber industry as well as an area for koalas.
Tony Callaghan from the Australian Workers Union, and that report by David Claughton with interviews by Kath Adams, Fiona Poole and the ABC regional team. 302 people died on Queensland's roads in 2024, and more than 7,500 people were hospitalised with injuries from road incidents. As Vanessa Jarrett reports, in the Central Highlands region, locals, medics and police are worried about the number of close calls.
When Casey Johnston drives to and from work, she's filled with trepidation.
I live in Comet and travel out to work every day, and it is just unreal, some of the behaviour you see. And most of it is just turning in to work every day can be quite scary. It's just so busy and people just seem not to be paying attention. People are going full speed at that point on the highway. Turning off can be a bit anxiety inducing.
Casey works at Rivalea, a Wagyu cattle station in the Central Highlands, a couple of hours west of Rockhampton. The property is located near Comet on the Capricorn Highway, the major arterial route in the region. On average, more than 3,300 vehicles travel on the highway between Emerald and Jeringa each day.
People just, get in cruise control and they just go. Like, they get in autopilot mode, and I just think people aren't being aware enough of who's around them on the road, like it's not just them.
The 580-kilometre-long Capricorn Highway stretches from Rockhampton in central Queensland and west to Barcaldine through cropping and cattle grazing country. Whether it's visiting tourists or well-travelled locals, Casey has a message for everyone. Slow down and give way.
Like with the cattle truck going out all the time and people needing to be a bit more gracious with, bigger vehicles and stuff like that, people just aren't aware enough, which is crazy because with the mines, like, we've got wide loads, cattle trucks, like, you just see all sorts of vehicles on this road. It kind of takes you aback how much people aren't respecting that. I remember back in the day when I was learning how to drive, it comes back to that, if you can't see their mirrors, they can't see you. It's just acknowledging the different paces that different vehicles can go. And
the region also has a heavy presence of mining, with more than 40 coal mines in the area, with workers driving in and out from shifts.
We have people who are put under pressure to be in places at a certain time. And we have people who are discharged from their employment and they don't live here and they do a drive-in, drive-out thing. And when that happens, they want to get home. They don't want to sit behind a cattle truck. This is a pipeline through to the west and to the north. So we have big trucks on the road all the time. Now, all of that is a recipe for disaster.
Dr. Ewan McPhee has been a GP in Emerald for 36 years. The town has a population of almost 15,000 and is located halfway along the highway. It is the largest town in the area and where most patients are sent after traffic incidents. According to the Department of Transport and Main Roads, speeding was the leading cause of fatal crashes in Queensland last year, responsible for 22% of all deaths on the road.
When I drive, constantly being passed on inclines, where there's double lines, people passing. Even if you did speed, you might get there 5 minutes earlier. But the fact is that worth dying over?
The road safety campaign, the Fatal Five, refers to speeding, drink driving, driver distraction, not wearing a seatbelt, and fatigue. Emerald Police Officer in Charge, Senior Sergeant Peter McFarlane, knows firsthand the effect they can have.
And I think if everyone's just to slow down a little bit and try and survive the drive. Ones we've seen recently, we've had, I think it was a total of 14 injury traffic crashes in July. So that's unacceptable. And when you do look into those and we investigate those, a lot of them are that Fatal Five, especially fatigue, speeding and drink driving.
One of those crashes in July was a head-on collision on the Capricorn Highway, killing four people, including two young children.
Obviously the families are absolutely devastated, extended families, but then it's also to the emergency service workers. We're still working through with our people who attended that scene. And you can imagine doing the door knock for those ones is just something you don't want to have to do in your career ever.
In March this year, $25 million was spent on a 5 kilometre stretch on the highway near Emerald, widening, improving lines and resealing. But even with the improvements, Senior Sergeant Peter McFarlane has one clear message to drivers.
I see you'd have to drive to the conditions of the road. You go further west in here, the roads can deteriorate. We have a lot of roads that probably a lot of opinions aren't up to speed, but if as long as you drive to those conditions, things are going to be okay. The highway itself is quite fine. Between here and Rocky is 110 kilometres out of zone, so the roads are actually okay. We've just got to just drive to those conditions and obey those Fatal Five.
Emerald Police Officer in Charge, Senior Sergeant Peter McFarlane, ending that story from Vanessa Jarrett. For almost 100 years, the entrance to the tiny town of O'Connell near Oberon in New South Wales has been lined by more than 100 trees in a tribute to the locals who served in the First World War. But local residents and historians are concerned about their future and the wider impact a proposed wind farm will have on the region. Hamish Cole has the story.
There are lots and lots of arguments going on today as to whether dear old England should be brought into the fray. But all right.
The town of O'Connell on the Central Tablelands has a very special and unique connection to the 66 local men and women who served in the Great War that continues to this day. After Lieutenant Edgar Gornell fought in World War I at Gallipoli and Pozieres in France, he moved to O'Connell, where he married his wife Jenny. As local historian Ian Brown explains, it was there that Mr. Gornell and his 17-year-old gardener Alan Todd came up with the idea to plant the trees that would become known as the O'Connell Anzac Memorial Avenue.
The avenue, it's a living war memorial honouring the men and women from O'Connell and District who first served in the First World War. The Anzac Avenue is of rare historical significance and it consists of 120 beautiful desert ash trees planted between 1925 and 1927. The whole O'Connell Anzac Memorial Avenue management plan is focused on the canopies of both sides of the trees closing in to connect each other with each other to form a cathedral effect. The symbol of grandeur and honour originally intended to move the hearts and minds of O'Connell residents, remains deeply significant to the community of O'Connell and District. It's a timeless tribute to the men and women of O'Connell and District who served in the First World War.
The trees have become an integral part of services that recognise the dozen locals who never returned home from World War One.
And O'Connell Public School is particularly active in promoting an understanding, and each child we have banners with the names of those who served, and at the Anzac Day service and at Remembrance Day, the banners are on posts in the ground next to the avenue, and some of the school children stand behind those banners, and at their time at the school, they stand behind the same person and they get to know who that person was. They say something about him at that person at the service. So the young people are very, very active in a very, very meaningful way as they stand next to those trees. It's something tangible that they learn about.
Residents are concerned that the Anzac Memorial is under a very modern threat. The proponents behind the proposed Paling Yards Wind Farm, Global Power Generation, are hoping to transport the project's 47 turbines through O'Connell if it receives approval from the state's planning department. A study conducted by consultants of GPG concluded that despite expecting contact to be made with up to a metre of the tree branches, no material damage will occur. Ian Brown again.
We don't want to have anything impinging on the reverence and the respect that's required for the meaning of those, the purpose of those trees. So we're concerned to maintain those trees and keeping in mind also the reverence, if you like. It is a war memorial and needs to be regarded as such.
Chris Muldoon is a member of the Oberon Against Wind Towers group and says any damage to the trees is not acceptable.
And the wind tower companies are now saying, we want to come through here with our massive wind tower trucks and we want to butcher your trees to make sure we can get through. I mean, I don't feel anyone, despite what they might feel about the role in renewable energy, The butchering of an Anzac Memorial by a European multinational wind tower developer doesn't make sense.
GPG were contacted for comment, and a detailed report on the potential impact of transporting the turbines is expected to be included in the company's response to submissions. A spokesperson for the Department of Planning, Housing and Infrastructure said they acknowledge the significance of the site and the issue will be considered in the agency's assessment of the project. For Mr. Muldoon, he believes the community faces a tough battle to save the trees.
We definitely understand that we are the underdog in this fight. On one side of the battle lines is the federal government and the state government and New South Wales Planning and the rest of the New South Wales Public Service and the developers, all of whom are on the same team. They are all aiming to roll out these wind towers as quickly as possible. On the other side of the battle line, if you like, are groups like ours. So, you know, it is a David Goliath type battle. But the concerns we have on that side, where you have so many powerful groups and levels of government working together, is that we feel they're going to rush them through. Is the developer being held to account?
Chris Muldoon from Oberon Against Wind Towers, ending that story from Hamish Cole on the O'Connell Anzac Memorial Avenue of Trees. A group of Indigenous Australians are using the power of fire to help regenerate a rare floral species in the New South Wales Barrington Tops. For almost a decade, ecologists have been working to increase numbers of the veined double-tailed orchid, which is not found anywhere else in the world. In 2019, after the Black Summer bushfires tore through the area, they had a breakthrough with thousands of the species sprouting across an area of the Tops, traditionally known as the Beanbean Plain. Since then, ecologists have been working with local Indigenous groups to carry out cultural burns at the plain to help the orchid thrive. Our reporter, Keely Johnson, took a trip up the Barrington Tops and has this story.
Today we're here at Beanbean. Picked a nice fresh day to be coming out. I think we're sitting around 4 degrees. We're in the all the Alps, I think, of the Tops. So beautiful plains, plenty of trees, plenty of creeks, lots of fungi around. It's a place now that I call a part of my home.
Worimi elder Michelle Perry is showing me around the Beanbean Plain.
It's an area at the top of the Barrington Tops in New South Wales, a place that Michelle and many other local First Nations people are deeply connected to.
It's too hard to explain the feeling or the sense of belonging on country and what it has done for myself and my family, and I just feel like we can't come here enough.
For almost a decade, ecologists have been working to increase numbers of a rare flower species endemic to the region. The veined double-tailed orchid, also known as the Bullagulga Wattoon, is not found anywhere else in the world. And in 2019, after the Black Summer bushfires tore through the area, they had a breakthrough.
Following the 2019 and 20 wildfires, fire jumped up on the plateau. In the burn footprint, the following season, we had 4,000 plants pop up right where the fire went through.
That's Senior Threatened Species Officer Luke Foster. He says he was keen to further explore the use of fire in the orchid's regeneration and got in touch with Michelle.
I was introduced to Michelle probably about 3 years ago. With her family's connection to up here, we started working together to come up with a plan to link Western science and traditional science together.
In 2023, about 60 people from a range of different Indigenous mobs carried out the first planned burn on the plain in more than 50 years.
First putting fire to this beautiful country, it was a sense of we're doing the right thing. It was our ancestors who was looking after us, I tell you. There was a sense of that they were giving approval, that they're there caring, watching. Everything just went so great.
Cultural burning is a traditional land management practice used by Indigenous Australians for millennia. It involves smaller, cooler and slower moving fires that are applied with a deep understanding of the local environment and its needs. In total, the group has carried out 3 burns on the plain, but they're still waiting to see if they've had an impact on the orchid.
After the first burn, we didn't have much response, but that was probably because it was a very cool burn. But yeah, hopefully after this burn, which was done at summer, after flowering, hopefully get a response.
Michelle says the burns have given many First Nations people across the region a chance to connect with each other and the land.
To get involved with the biodiversity team, Conservation Division and National Parks, it's been the best thing, I think one of the best things that's happened for me and my family, to bring us back on country to learn about an endangered orchid. We're lucky enough to rename it the Bullagulga Wattoon, which means the two-tailed white one.
The Barrington Tops National Park and the adjoining state conservation area are the traditional lands of several groups, predominantly the Biripi, Warramai and Wanneroo people. Michelle says pre-colonisation, the Biambiam Plain is believed to have been a meeting place for different tribes.
You know, when you look around, definitely you can see it's a meeting, gathering place. You know, you got Wanneroo to one side, you got the Biripi and all the Warramai. Had to be maybe a trading place, a meeting place.
The most recent burn in February this year saw almost 150 First Nations people involved in not only the burn, but other cultural activities such as wood carving and weaving. Michelle says the experience was healing for herself, for her family, but especially for her nan.
Because my nan was taken when she was 14 to work around on stations all around the Barrington area. I did get to bring up a couple of times to the Barrington and back to around the Gloucester in that area. I often wondered, she would get quite emotional coming back into the towns and into Barrington. And I often think those tears, were they of sorrow or were they of joy or whether they were both? So this was a very special place to her. And since we've been coming here now since 2023, it's become a very, very special place to me and my family.
Michelle says she's still learning about her culture, particularly about cultural burns, and she's appreciated guidance from the government's threatened species team and the New South Wales National Parks.
I want to learn as much as I can, and if it means involved, you know, we're working with National Parks, because we haven't got our elders around to tell us those stories. I want to pass as much as I can back onto our youth and our younger ones.
Where Are My Elder, Michelle Perry, ending that story from Keely Johnson. And that is Australia-wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.